It often ran through my mind that as I was almost always drunk and was constantly having affairs with these infected women, then even if for some reason I had so far no obvious symptom of these diseases, in all probability I was already infected by one of them. So I decided to consult various specialists in order to find out what would be the early symptoms of any of the diseases I might have caught. Although none of the local specialists found anything wrong with me, I continued to worry, because my fear of these diseases, as well as my own common sense, supported my conviction that I most certainly already be infected. All this brought me to the point at which I decided to have a consultation here in Paris, regardless of cost, with the leading specialists in the whole of Europe. I could afford this expense because, owing to the World War, transportation had broken down and the price of commodities had gone sky high, and our firm, having very large stocks of dried fruit in all our warehouses, made considerable profits that year, a good share of which fell to me. These European celebrities, after all kinds of highly detailed investigations and what are called chemical analyses of their own invention, unanimously pronounced that there was not the slightest trace of venereal disease in my organism. This conclusion of theirs put an end to my chronic worry about my health, and on the other hand, it implanted in me such a strong desire and curiosity to clear up this question that from then on it became a sort of mania with me, a kind of idée fixe. From that time, my serious observation and study of everything concerning these diseases animated and justified what I called my miserable life and gave it meaning. During this period of my life, I made these observations and studies always with my whole inner real eye, whether in a drunk, half-drunk, or sober state. Among other things, I also read with avidity literature of all kinds dealing with these diseases, including most of the books written on this question in French and German. This was easy for me because, as you see, I have such a command of French that you could hardly guess that I'm not a real French intellectual. And I get along very well in German, too, because I lived a fairly long time in Germany, and for want of something to do, I studied their language and literature in my spare time. So when I became interested in this question, I was able to acquaint myself with all the information existing in contemporary civilization on the subject of venereal disease. In these books, hundreds of theories and hundreds of hypotheses were given about the causes of venereal infection, but I could not discover one convincing explanation of why some people are infected with these diseases and others not. I soon became convinced that I would not be able to learn this from the knowledge of this question existing at the present time here in Europe. However, from all this literature, of course, putting aside a multitude of thick scientific books whose contents prove at first glance to every more or less normal person that they were written by complete ignoramuses regarding these questions, that is to say, people knowing nothing at all about human disease, I got the definite impression that people become infected by venereal disease owing exclusively to their uncleanliness. When I reached this categorical conclusion, there was nothing left for me but to concentrate all my attention upon finding out what there was in my personal cleanliness that had so far protected me against infections. I began to deliberate as follows. I do not dress any more cleanly than anyone else living here in Europe. I wash my hands and face every morning like everyone else. Once a week I make a point of going to a Turkish bath, also, it seems, like everyone. In short, I turned over many things in my mind and found nothing in which I was exceptional in this respect, and yet the fact remained that with my loathsome life I ran every risk of infection. From then on, my thoughts were guided by two impartial convictions already fully rooted in me. The first, that sooner or later, anyone having relations with these women must inevitably be infected. And the second, that only cleanliness protects one from such infection. I continued to reflect in this manner for a whole week, until, suddenly, I remembered a certain habit of mine, which I have always scrupulously concealed from my European acquaintances, the habit which we in Persia call abdast. The practice of abdast, or as it might be called, ablution, is one of the principal customs among us in Persia. Strictly speaking, every follower of Islam must conform to this practice, but it is followed scrupulously only by Muslims of the Shiite sect. And, as almost the whole of Persia is composed of Shiites, the custom is nowhere so widely spread as among us. The custom of abdast consists, for every adherent of the Shiite sect, male as well as female, in never failing to wash the sex organs after each visit to the water closet. For this purpose, each family has certain appurtenances considered indispensable among us, consisting of a special vessel, a particular kind of jug called ibrik. And the richer the family, the more of these jugs they must have, since one of them must be put at the disposal of every newly arrived guest. I myself was also accustomed to this habit from early childhood, and it gradually so entered into my daily life that even when I came to Europe, where this custom does not exist, I could not live a single day without making these ablutions. In fact, it is much easier for me to go without washing my face, even when I have a hangover, than not to wash certain parts of my body with cold water after going to the water closet. Since I've been living here in Europe, I have to put up with a great many inconveniences on account of this habit of mine, and even have to forego all the modern comforts which I could easily afford. For instance, here in Paris, I could easily afford to live at the best hotel with every modern convenience. But, thanks to this habit of mine, I'm obliged to live in some dingy hotel far from the center and from all the places where I need to go every day. In the hotel where I live at the moment, the only comfort is the one that is essential for me. Since the building is of old construction, it still has old-fashioned water closets instead of those new American inventions. And it is just that old system which is the most convenient and suitable for this habit of mine. Who knows? Perhaps I even half-consciously chose France as my chief dwelling place, because it is still possible to find everywhere, especially in the provinces, water closets of the old system, such as we have in Persia. In the other countries of Europe, this Asian system, as they call it, scarcely exists anymore. It has been almost entirely supplanted by the American system, with its comfortable, well-polished easy chairs, upon which I personally could only loll and read their famous book entitled The Decameron. And so, my honorable doctor, on suddenly remembering this habit of mine, I understood at once, without any further doubt, that if I had hitherto escaped infection by some nasty disease, it was solely because I frequently wash my sex organs with cold water. After these words, this unhappy young Persian raised his arms and exclaimed with his whole being, "Blessed forever be the memory of those who created for us this beneficial custom." For a long while he said nothing further, but looked pensively at a party of Americans sitting nearby who were arguing about whether women dress better in England or America. Then suddenly he turned to me and he said, "My dear and highly esteemed doctor, during my acquaintance with you, I have become convinced that you are a man of broad culture and very well educated. Perhaps you would be kind enough to give me your considered opinion so that I may at least at last understand and solve a certain problem which during recent years has often aroused my curiosity and disturbed my thoughts at the moment when I am comparatively sober. How is it that since living here in Europe, where people profess the religion practiced by almost half of humanity, I have, so far, not come across a single good custom in their ordinary life, whereas among those of us who profess Islam, there are so many that are excellent? What is wrong? What is the reason for this? Were there no good ordinances established by the founders of that great religion for the ordinary life of its followers? Well, my boy, as this young Persian had won my sympathy in the course of our acquaintance, I could not refuse to reply to his question, so I decided to give him some explanation, but of course in such a form that he would not suspect who I was, nor what was my genuine nature. I told him, "You say that in the religion professed by half of humanity, and you are probably speaking of the Christian religion, there are not such good customs as in your Islam. How so? On the contrary, that religion has many more good customs than any of the other religions today. In none of the ancient religious teachings were so many good regulations laid down for ordinary everyday life as in the teaching on which the Christian religion was founded. But if the followers of this great religion themselves, especially those who were called the fathers of the church of the Middle Ages, treated this religion step by step as Bluebeard treated his wives, torturing it and destroying all the beauty and charm, that indeed is quite a different matter. You must know that in general, all the great and genuine religions which have existed down to the present time and were created, as history itself testifies, by men of equal attainment in regards to the perfection of their pure reason, are always based on the same truths. The difference between these religions lies only in the definite indications given for the observance of certain details concerning what are called rituals. And this difference results from the way the great founders intentionally adapted their indications to suit the level of mental development of the people of the given epoch. At the root of every new doctrine upon which a religion is based, dogmas are always to be found belonging to earlier religions and already well fixed in the life of the people. This fully justifies the saying which has existed among people from olden times, "There is nothing new under the sun." The only new things in each of these religious teachings are, as I have said, the small details, intentionally adapted by the great founders to the level of mental development of the people of the given epoch.